The first item is the confirmation of the the Board of Invention, and I had a discussion with Senator Michelle, the ranking member of the Republican group here, and we kind of decided that instead of bringing all these folks in, they've served well in the past, and they're recommended by the governor, and they're from all over the state, and we didn't think it was necessary to hear from each and every one of them today. So if that's not acceptable, we'll set up another meeting. But we've talked about this with Senator Michelle and a couple others, and they're all serving in good stead. And so I'm going to recommend that somebody make a motion to it's Candace Campbell, Mary Sue Collins, Weston Cutter, Pat Dillon, Randall Olson, Leonard Peterson, Teresa Santiago, and Andrew Wells. And I believe they're all, obviously the governor is recommending all of these people, and their credentials are all in the, your packet. If you'd like a second or two to look at them, I don't know. But Senator Dade, did you wish to make the motion? Yeah, what's the proper motion? Is there one?
The committee recommended the Senate appoint the nominations of appointment.
Okay, we know the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The next item on the agenda for today is Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board, the IRRB, Sandy Lehman. Welcome to the committee, and we're just going to let you take off and tell us about yourself and hopefully some good things you're doing there. And
absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Metzen, and thank you, members of the committee. I really appreciate this opportunity to appear before you and talk about some of the things that have been happening in the last 4 years at Iron Range Resources. I'd like to take about 7 minutes to do so, if I could. And first, I'd like to start off with a little bit of an introduction to me. My name is Sandy Lehman. I was appointed commissioner by Governor Pawlenty in early 2003 and confirmed by the Senate in 2004. Prior to that, I was president of Itasca Development Corporation, and prior to that, I was president of the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce. I currently serve on the boards of the Center for Rural Policy and Development and serve on the board of the Natural Resource Research Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth. I just completed a 12-year term as a trustee of the Blandon Foundation. So that's a little bit about myself. Now, to introduce you to the Iron Range and provide you with a little bit of the sense of enthusiasm for the things that are happening in the Iron Range right now, I'd like to show you a 3-minute video.
I don't know, there's something about her. We came up here to because we loved the area.
There's a million things out here.
Yeah, it gives them a great place to raise their families. The schools are really wonderful up here. It's a great town. There's a lot of nice areas. If you want to live on the lake, or if you want to live out in the country, or if you live right in the middle of downtown. The commutes are fairly short. We're not going to have traffic jams, except maybe at the boat landing.
Very committed people, very creative people, very honest people.
Well, our success is first and foremost the employees that we have here. Hourly and salary, great sense of urgency, we get a lot of things done.
I think one of the biggest advantages that the Iron Range offers is a highly skilled workforce, a highly trained workforce.
The work ethic of the employees we have here, I think, is superior to many around the country.
The work ethic here is amazing.
There's an excess of money available, there's an excess of jobs on land. There's an excess of labor up here. Believe it or not, a lot of people can't believe that, but there's an excess of labor. This was always a dream of mine, to have a business and grow here.
We're doing it here in Ely, Minnesota.
We've almost tripled our size since we've been up on the range. You know, we would have still grown if we were in other markets, just because of the business we've got, but I don't know that we would have grown as fast and as smoothly as we have without being up here, because the cooperativeness of the lending organizations to get us money for equipment and things like that.
Our customers aren't here. Our customers are literally all over the country. We work closely. We export our products over to 5 countries. We import things that we need that are hard to find in this area or, you know, in the United States in general.
Customers within the U.S., of course, and also in the United Kingdom and across the Pacific Rim.
In this day and age, there's technology. You can do anything anywhere. And I think that you get the quality of life here that you don't get anywhere else.
It's a great time to be doing business on the range. The global economy, the national economy is going strong. It's a very good time for the range.
The cost of living here is, of course, much less than in Minneapolis, and the quality of living is much greater. So we haven't had any problem at all finding employees. We generally have a stack of resumes on the left.
Well, that's interesting. The cost of the life is better, I'm sorry. There I go, get me from Leicester, Minnesota.
That's right.
It's a great place to live. It's a small town, but we have a lot of big town amenities with the shopping and restaurants. Reliable power grid, connectivity that we get to the outside world with multiple internet providers. You can get high speed into your home from almost anywhere.
I love it here. Business is doing business in Minnesota is
beautiful.
If you're willing to.
Business is beautiful.
Thanks, Mark. Well, business hasn't always been beautiful, and life hasn't always been beautiful on the Iron Range. Just before I came on as commissioner, I was speaking with the governor because one of the taconite mines in Eveleth had just declared bankruptcy and closed. The year prior, National Steel had likewise declared bankruptcy, and 400 jobs were in jeopardy. Times looked a little tough. We had what you might call a burning platform, and people were asking, which way do we jump? When I came on as commissioner, Governor Pawlenty asked me to lead a state team to work with potential buyers of EVTAC and put together a team that would make this thing happen and would reopen the plant in expedited fashion. By December of the year of the bankruptcy, 400 people were back at work. The production lines were running. That is what a state agency can do in working with businesses to create and retain jobs. Beyond that, I co-chaired the governor's committee on Minnesota's mining future to look at where the state is going in promotion of mining. And then later, participated as the lead of the steel and mining delegation to the governor's trade mission on China in recognition of the global impact that China is having on Minnesota and the very direct impact that it's having in a positive fashion on the Iron Range. In fact, a Chinese company has partial ownership in a taconite production plant, former EVTAC, that's now UnitedTAC in Eveleth. It's the only Chinese direct investment in the state of Minnesota is on the Iron Range. Currently, I'm co-chair of the governor's task force on the competitiveness of the primary forest products industry. Again, another industry that goes through cycles and has had a recent crisis with the closure of the Ainsworth facility. We've just delivered a short-term report to the governor that has resulted in several pieces of legislation that are moving forward right now. And Commissioner of the DNR, Mark Holston, and I are co-chairing the task force as we move forward on some longer-term recommendations. Now, in addition to that, in the past 4 years, the agency has been a catalyst in investing in some major projects: Mesaba Nugget, Minnesota Steel, Excelsior Energy, Franconia Minerals, PolyMet are just a few of those. These projects actually represent over $5 billion in potential investment in the Iron Range in the coming 5 years. But it's also important to work on diversification of employment on the Iron Range. Why is that? If you look at the last 10 years and you look at employment numbers, actual employment numbers in mining and timber production companies in northeastern Minnesota have declined by more than 30% in the last 5 years. So we work in diversification. In the last 4 years, our agency has negotiated and invested through low-interest loans and some small equity placements over $53 million in financial investments, which in turn has leveraged over $330 million in private investment in the last 4 years. That means the agency has directly had an impact in creating or retaining over 4,500 jobs in the last 4 years. When you track that on employment and you take out mining and you take out forest products and look at our record on diversification, in the last 3 years, we have increased employment in the non-natural resource sectors by 9.1%. Wages, average weekly rate wages in that same period have increased by 7.4%. So, looking to the future, what do we see in the future? I think that in addition to these large projects and the diversification efforts, the Iron Range is prepared to jump on the renewable energy bandwagon in a really big way. Currently, we're partnering with the Boise Fort Band of Chippewa to study the feasibility of developing a cellulosic ethanol plant in northeastern Minnesota. This is in addition to investments in two biomass facilities that just started, Laurentian Biomass Project in Hibbing and in Virginia, and potential wind energy projects that Minnesota Power may be involved in. In addition, in preparing the region for the 21st century, I led a delegation to the state of Utah. Senator Tomasoni and Representative Sertich were a part of that, to look at a one-of-a-kind project, one-of-a-kind in the nation and maybe the world, in a fiber-to-the-premise, where 14 communities are sharing high-speed connectivity in small communities across the mountain range in Utah. We're looking at replicating that on the Iron Range. Right now, our agency is partnering with the Blandin Foundation. I think you heard from the Blandin Foundation about a week ago on that project. We don't know if we know it's going to be very expensive. We don't know whether it's possible, but it's something we need to do. We need to be thinking about how do we connect our communities to prepare themselves for the 21st century. In closing, I would just like to say that having lived and worked and raised my family in a rural community, I've really wrestled with the challenges that are faced by our businesses and communities in rural Minnesota. And if you haven't guessed already, I have a real passion for these issues, and I try and live that passion every day and bring that passion to my work. I'm honored and privileged to serve as Commissioner of Iron Range Resources, and I'm pledged to continue to balance the needs of the Iron Range Resources Agency, the board, elected leaders, communities, and businesses. While the needs and the desires of those various constituencies are sometimes in conflict, we all have the same goal, and that's creating a sustainable economy in the mining area of the state of Minnesota. Thank you. I'd like to entertain any questions that you may have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, fine. Very good. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, your reappointment has been an agonizing process for the range members of the legislature. We have wished you only the best the last 4 years as you try to lead really a premier economic development agency in the state. And we're very proud of the work that's been done at the agency over the years. But, you know, all of us in our jobs, I guess, go through a period once in a while where we go through a job evaluation. And we've had a great deal of discussion about that among the members of the Range Legislative Delegation in the last few weeks. And, commissioners, there's quite a bit of frustration that you haven't been a strong enough advocate for the agency in the governor's office. And because, members, this commissioner is paid for with local tax dollars, not state dollars, different than our other commissioners here in the state. She's paid for locally. And because it's a state agency that's not funded by the general fund, it seems a little odd that it's considered an executive branch of government, that it even is a state agency, but it is. And the commissioner often gets torn between the governor's direction, who appointed her, and the range legislators who control the board. And, you know, some people say that the DNR commissioner is probably one of the harder commissioner jobs in the state, because they have so many small little interest groups. And, you know, I wouldn't argue that that's probably a pretty tough job, but there's nothing easy about being the commissioner of the IRRRB, especially when you're a Republican governor's appointment, and we all understand that you have to answer to the governor. But our frustration has been around not advocating in the governor's office for northeastern Minnesota. And your recent decision to refuse, after the board passed a resolution requesting the commissioner sign a letter to provide some state help for the wood products industry, I would argue close to on life support right now, our wood products industry in northern Minnesota. We have two plants shut down that consume about 25% of all the wood that's cut in the state goes into those plants, and they're shut down. And the board at their December board meeting asked the commissioner to sign a letter to the governor requesting an appropriation to deed to help the wood products industry. And the commissioner and I had a discussion before the board meeting. And, Commissioner, I got to tell you, when you told me you're not going to lobby your boss, I was very disappointed, because you are our connection to the governor's office, and you are our advocate in the governor's office. And, members, what you need to know is, in law, the IRRRB can only spend our taconite tax money in the taconite relief area. We can't spend it anywhere else. And we have a wood products industry that's much larger than the taconite relief area. In fact, we're just a part of the wood products industry in northern Minnesota. And we were willing to spend $2 million to try and help our small little logging and vendor community be able to cash flow along until the plants reopen. And the board asked the commissioner to just request from the governor that he support an appropriation to deed to help the rest of the wood products community that the agency can't help. All the loggers and vendors in Coochaching County up to International Falls, everything west of Deer River, much of Itasca County, Cass County, all of Beltrami County, and Senator Scoy knows wood products is a big business in his district also. And we had quite a tussle with the commissioner, and I think to date, even though the board passed a resolution requesting the commissioner, you might say, lobby the governor for some help, I don't think that letter's been written yet. And I don't quite understand why, that when we have a commissioner on the range, it seems like that should be our connection to the governor's office. And I know other commissioners personally, some of them are good friends, and I know they're in the governor's office and with his staff frequently lobbying for initiatives at their agency. And we fund many of those, and there are commissioner initiatives in the governor's office. And that's been, Commissioner, my strongest disappointment, that we can't get the governor's ear like a member of the governor's cabinet can. And we just badly need you or whoever the next commissioner is going to be a stronger advocate for the agency in the governor's office. And I say that with all sincerity. Another criticism that I've heard from members of the range legislative delegation is the fact that from time to time you've gotten out in front of the board and put the board in very difficult situation of having to then try and back up when when hope was raised for people, and my most recent example, I guess, members, is the idea that we were going to spend $2 million to try help the logging community in the Taconite Relief Area. That, I think, was a good initiative, but the plan you put together, Commissioner, was totally inadequate, and it was well-publicized in industry publications. A big press release went out from the agency, and it was front page in the newspaper that the agency is going to do this for the logging community before the board had any opportunity to have any input. And ultimately, we had to recommend that the governor release the money or it can't be released. And it put board members in a very difficult situation of not wanting to help our wood products industry. We want to help them, but the program that was suggested was really going to do little. So fortunately, we were able to pull together a group of range lawmakers and work with the commissioner, and I'm glad you had a willingness to try and modify that program, and we eventually passed a modified proposal of that $2 million. But it was agonizing for the board members because there had already been this perception that the agency was going to do this before the board had even been consulted. So it puts us in a very difficult political situation with a very large player in our area's economy. And we got through it, but, Commissioner, it's not helpful when you get too far out in front of the board members in the newspaper and with press releases before you know if the board is actually on board. And I guess the third criticism, and then I won't go on any longer, is oftentimes board members have said it seems like the agency is all about process, and we're about creating new little subgroups to meet, and we're about having meetings and sending staff to meetings. And I've been to rather meaningless meetings where there was a half a dozen staff people sitting there and sitting there doing not much of anything. And at the direction of the commissioner, I would think, and when really the focus of the agency needs to be trying to create jobs for our region. And it just seems like we're getting, under your leadership, pretty bogged down in process and window dressing. We've got new furniture. We have new carpeting. We have a new driveway. All nice stuff, but doesn't put any range citizens to work, which I think is really the mission of the agency, is to try not only diversify the range's economy, but add additional value to our resources. And, Commissioner, I thought that Job Z was tailor-made for the Iron Range. I carried the bill here for the governor, and I thought nobody is going to be more successful with Job Z than the Iron Range is, because we had not only the state tax incentives, we had a very strong economic development agency, staff on board, money, that nobody could put an economic development package together any better than the range could. And I got to tell you, members, we're 4 years down the road, and as the author of the bill, I can tell you where I live, it has been a dismal failure. And I'm disappointed with that because I was hopeful. And, Commissioner, I don't think, certainly can't blame you for that. I don't know if we've had the emphasis at the agency we should to try and put those two things together. I think we've tried, but somehow we haven't quite got it done. But we've had very, very, very little success with it. And, and I told the commissioner when I had breakfast with her the other day, maybe economic development in Minnesota, rural Minnesota, is just harder to do. Maybe it just can't be done. Maybe there are some regions where the impediments are so strong, the distance and transportation and labor force and different issues, obstacles we have in rural areas. Maybe no matter how hard we try, we just can't do it. And I sure hope that's not the case, that at some point we can figure that out. But I remember when the governor traveled around with his Job Z program, into rural towns. Hundreds of people showed up. Hundreds of people showed up before it ever passed the legislature because they were hopeful that something could happen in those small towns. And other than a few isolated places, not much has happened. And it hasn't happened at the agency. And people at the range, on the range are just, I think, pretty disappointed that the agency for years, before Commissioner Lehman was there, just hasn't had the kind of leadership that we've needed. And as board members, we're all responsible for some of that. But Commissioner, I feel pretty strongly, and I don't know who the governor would recommend for a second choice if you weren't confirmed, but I think I speak for the range legislators when I say you're just not providing the leadership to drive the agency to create the employment that people are very, very hungry for. You know, I often say here, you know, the range is known for exporting stuff. You know, Duluth wouldn't have a port, and they're pretty proud of their world port. Duluth wouldn't have a port if it wasn't for the Iron Range, because 58% of all the cargo that's ever went out of that port is iron ore. And we made the lumber that built the Midwest with some biggest white pine sawmill in the world, and we're all proud of that history. But a lot of our people would like to stay. We export paper, and we export other wood products, and we export iron ore. But the thing people are really tired of exporting is our people. And people are hungry for jobs. They're hungry for young people to have an opportunity to stay and live on the range when they complete their education. A lot of people living down here in the metropolitan area are hungry for some economic opportunity to come home. And as we go forward, as long as I'm here, I'm going to continue to advocate for employment so those families at least, and a lot of those young kids want to leave. Someday a whole lot of them want to come back. But they at least should have the option. And right now, they don't. And we haven't seen the kind of leadership, I think, that the range needs, that it deserves, that I think it should expect. And so I'm very torn, Commissioner, as to what to do here today. I've talked with you about it. I've talked with the governor about it. Talked to much of the commissioner's staff about it, the governor's staff. I've talked to employees at the agency about it. And right now yet, I'm a little uncertain where to go. And I guess these are the kind of decisions we get election certificates to make. But, Mr. Chairman, if we send this recommendation to the floor that we recommend the commissioner be reappointed, there will be a loud cry from the range, we can do better. And that only could be done with the cooperation of the governor, I guess. I guess I would yield to Senator Tomasoni for some of his observations. You know, all of the range legislators sit on the board and have been frustrated. We haven't had a issue of having a commissioner come to us after 4 years of experience, and I think that's a little different. I've heard many members say, well, gee, I think the governor should get their appointment. The governor should get his staff. And I understand that. Maybe we should consider that he gets his team. But when somebody's been on the team for 4 years and really hasn't met the expectations we had hoped for, I think it's a good thing to come back and reevaluate whether we continue down that road. And that's what this process, I think, is intended to do. And so, Mr. Chairman, I don't know exactly what my motion is yet today, if I'm called on to make it, but I'd like to yield to Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Michelle.
I wonder if it would be
appropriate to have
the commissioner respond to some of the some of the suggestions that Senator Bach
I was thinking that too. Maybe let her, while it's fresh, and said I have four or five people. Let Commissioner Lehman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bach. You know, you've always been a strong advocate for the Iron Range. And I think I told you that when I first came on as commissioner that I saw you as an effective leader. And now you are in an even more significant position of leadership. And it's an awesome responsibility. And so I appreciate that you are taking your responsibility seriously. I put before you the facts on what we've accomplished in the last 4 years, 9.1% increase in non-natural resource employment, over 6.1% increase in employment overall. Average wages increased measurably over the last 4 years. Those are the measurements that we establish for ourselves as we try and measure what impact we're having on the Iron Range. I feel as though my past 4 years have been very successful. I feel that that record speaks for itself. I think the excitement that is being generated on the Iron Range right now is almost unprecedented. When I think about the difference between my first week on the job and this week on the job, it's quite remarkable. Now, I'd be the last person to say that it's all because Sandy Lehman is Commissioner of Iron Range Resources. We all know that isn't how economic development works. But what you do as commissioner is you assemble your team and you put together your organization to play its role in the most effective way that we can. If we ever have six people at a meeting doing nothing, I'd like to know about it. We have, in my time, reduced the staff complement by 30%. We have cut out obsolete programs, and we've refocused on economic development. We cannot afford to waste a dollar. We can put some dollars out there at risk. We can place some bets, but we need to be focused on economic development, and I think I've brought that focus. If I could just address the one point about the forest industry products program, I will agree, Senator Bach, that it was uncomfortable when a program is presented and not all board members have had an opportunity to react. That's what does happen sometimes when you're faced with a crisis, as we were with the Ainsworth shutdown. And the governor reacted very quickly, very responsively, with a suggestion of what we might do. I apologize if there was any confusion about what we were doing. The communication from our agency was that there may be a $2 million loan program available pending board approval. When I learned that the board members were not supportive of the loan program, rather than bringing that loan program to the table, I worked with the board behind the scenes to create an alternative program that they would be comfortable with. It's not the perfect program either. Maybe there is no perfect program, but they did present a program, and we're working on trying to implement that program right now. But it's a crisis situation with the logging infrastructure. We're in danger of losing potentially 300 logging jobs in northeastern Minnesota. And so sometimes you need to react quickly. You can't wait to have meetings. You need to respond as you would quickly and responsibly in a crisis. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to comment on one thing the commissioner said, and I don't want to get in that tit for tat, but what I'm talking about, members, is leadership. And in the 2003 session, it was suggested that the agency, because of losing the LTV plant, the production tax is way down, our revenue stream is shrinking, we need to try to downsize the agency. So I put into the Environment Finance Bill an early retirement incentive program that the previous commissioner had worked on and passed it in the Senate. And we got to conference committee, and then Chief of Staff Charlie Weaver said, We realize there's no state money in this, and we realize there's no cost to the state, but we're very concerned about setting an early retirement precedent in our first session as governor. So could we please not go forward, and let's consider this next year. So I agreed, and we didn't pass the provision into law, even though there was no state cost. So the next winter, right before session in December, I was over at the Department of Revenue with a meeting on taconite taxes, a number of people there. The commissioner was there. And I said, Commissioner, I really want to do this early retirement program. And Commissioner, your comment to me was, well, the governor doesn't support it. So I drafted the bill. We put it in the finance bill, and we passed it into law, and the governor didn't object. But members, it was me that provided the leadership that lowered the complement at the agency so we could offer early retirements to, I think, 9 people. And that they took, and it was a good package. It didn't cost the state any money. It reduced the complement at the agency. We all benefited. But members of the legislature or the board shouldn't have to take that initiative. I mean, and Commissioner, you certainly shouldn't have responded, the governor doesn't support it, so we're not going to try it. I mean, if it was the right thing for the agency, and we agreed on that, it shouldn't matter what the governor thinks. The commissioner should be lobbying that governor's office that this is something the agency needs to do. We don't have the money we used to have. We have to reduce our complement. And you didn't do that. Fortunately, we resurrected the proposal, and members of the legislature agreed that it was a good thing to do, and we got it done. But I think it's a little unfair for you to in any way imply that the fact that the complement has been reduced at the agency, you had much to do with it. Now, I realize you negotiated under the parameters of the legislature, gave you the package for people, and ultimately the board approved it. But that's just kind of one of the leadership things, and they've been multiple of them down the road that where you just haven't provided the leadership and the advocacy to the governor's office, where not only me but other members of the range delegation have been frustrated that you haven't advocated hard enough in the governor's office. And we didn't want any money. We just wanted to be able to ask a few people to retire. And that doesn't seem like that would have been that hard to try in the governor's office drive home that this is a proposal worth pursuing. But I just wanted to respond to the reduction of the complement, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion?
Well,
Senator Tabasoni?
Mr. Chairman, I just have to add a few things. I was chairman of the board, and there's nothing more frustrating than reading about something in the paper before you find out about it. And very, very little communication between the commissioner and myself whenever something. It was almost like, let's keep it a secret from the board until we have to tell them at the last second. And it was a frustrating thing to have to be making some of the decisions that we made as a result of some of the ways the leadership or lack thereof was conducted at the agency. We had, for example, we've asked for the commissioner to advocate for restoring of the 21st Century Minerals Fund, and she wouldn't do it. We have asked her to put in proposals for bonding so that we can fix some roofs at Giants Ridge and at the agency and at Iron World, and she wouldn't do it. Senator Bach just mentioned the letter that she wouldn't write. We had a situation where these are not people that were ready to retire. These are people that had been working at the agency for 20 years. They had families on the Iron Range. They were loyal supporters of these good state jobs. We made sure we found enough money to keep these people working, and they got laid off anyway. And I have no idea what happened to the $350,000 that we supplied for it. At one point in time, there was a proposal coming out of the commissioner's office to give Cleveland Cliffs $5 million that they didn't want or need. And, you know, it's the kind of stuff that you're sitting there saying, well, you know, she's a very good person to serve on boards. She has a real lot of ability to do that kind of stuff. But leading the agency isn't I don't think, is the commissioner's strong point. And many of us would like to see a change, and I know this is a governor's appointee. And, you know, after you've had 4 years of experience of somebody being in charge, you find out what they can and can't do. And we're all of the notion that we do need a change in leadership at the board, at the commissioner's level. And we also understand that there's a lot of politics involved here. And so I for one would like to see the change, but I also know that the governor would not like to see the change, which has some implications. So I think what I'm going to do, Mr. Chairman, is that I'm going to make a motion that the committee refer the appointment of Sandy Lehman to the floor, but it be sent without recommendation.
In the form of a motion, I take it. Discussion on the motion by Senator Tomasoni to move it to the Senate floor,
Mr. Chair,
without recommendation. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate what I think is a gesture of trying to be open-minded here from Senator Tomasoni and Senator Bach. I hope, Mr. Chair, we have a high bar, a high threshold when we talk about dumping a commissioner. That should not be an act that we take lightly. And Commissioner Lehman, what I've seen and read, has served with distinction. The amount of investment, the new jobs, heading north, this is a success story. And this is who the governor has picked, and this is who we have confirmed as a Senate in the past, and this is who the governor wants to stick with. And barring more than her failure to sign a letter or her failure to fix the global economy, you know, I wish we were moving to with a much more positive recommendation out of this committee. But I want to thank Commissioner Lehman. I think Senator Bach had it right. This probably is the toughest commissioner job in the state. Thinking about who she has to answer to.
Oh, Lord, you're talking about you guys.
But I think she's done it well. I think she's done it well. I think we're lucky. And Mr. Chairman, I don't think we should have these confirmation squabbles. I don't think the Minnesota Senate should start looking more and more like the U.S. Congress. Well, let's not do that. That's not Minnesota. That's not your committee, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, are you done?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't have the opportunity to meet with the commissioner before the meeting today, but she tried to do that. I've just been really busy. But I knew that there were undertones of concern that I'd heard expressed from, you know, DFLers and Republicans alike about what the plan was, and, you know, with the Senate DFL, I suppose, in particular, in terms of confirming commissioner. But I said to my friends from the range delegation that I was going to listen and kind of decide for myself if there were concerns that warranted not recommending or recommending no confirmation, whatever path that took. I have to say that I'm thinking about other agencies, and I think it really is the task of the commissioner to be a promoter for that agency. And I have to say that I did listen to every word, and I listened to what you had to say, and I think I'm glad that things are better. But I know that the range is a wonderful state asset, but it's one we need to, you know, that needs our investment in terms of our energy and our time and our dollars as well. And as Senator Bach pointed out, the dollars we're talking about with the IRRRB are our local dollars, if you will. So I'm concerned that
that the delegation and two esteemed members, I say that in all seriousness. I mean, I think maybe you're tough, but that's okay because you've got a lot to fight for and work for your districts. It's different than the district I represent, even though I have to advocate for that as well. But it's different and it's more intense, and it's more there's more urgency, at least in terms of economic development. So I think I'm inclined to support Senator Tomasoni's motion. I will.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and Commissioner. I heard, listened to what you said, and I listened about the 9% non-natural resources jobs and the 6% employment and the measurable income and increase. We don't know though if you would have been advocating in the governor's office if it could have been better. We don't know that, but I guess my question is, why not write the letter? Why not advocate what the board is requesting you in the governor's office? I would guess that, different executives deal differently with their staff, but, my perception is that, Governor Plenty would like to hear an advocacy from the commissioner and like to have an opportunity to hear the differing positions that the board have. So why not do that?
Commissioner Lehman.
Can I respond, Mr.
Yes,
Chair and
me.
Senator? Yeah. And maybe I should have addressed that specific concern more fully. Governor Plenty wants me to be an advocate for the Iron Range. Governor Plenty is an advocate for the Iron Range. We're privileged to have a state agency that has a regional focus at a cabinet level that provides me with the opportunity to talk to the governor and his staff on a regular basis. That provides me with the opportunity in this case to work very directly with the governor in developing a program for loggers. I am advocating strongly with the governor and, in fact, am co-chairing the task force on primary forest products, developing over $8 million in suggested incentives as a result of that work. The letter in question that we talked about was simply a matter of process, simply a matter of form. I have no problem in advocating with the governor, and I have done so. The board had asked that we not release any of our funding until the match had been advocated through a letter form. We're still working on that program and seeing how that unfolds regionally. But Senator Scow and senators, I can tell you that Northeastern Minnesota has a key advocate in its commissioner, and I'm pleased that I have a governor that listens. I think that probably hasn't been since the time of Governor Perpich that we have seen as many visits by a governor as we have with Governor Plenty on the Iron Range. We've had reason for that. We've had good times and we've had bad times. We've had good things to celebrate, and the governor has been there. But he's also been there during the really tough times, the closure of the Ainsworth Mills, the shutdown of two paper mills at Blandon Paper Company, the shutdown of a taconite mine. And I've been there alongside him to implement responses to those crises. Now, I need to always balance that with board members who we know are of a different political party. And that's a balance that we work at every day. And the important thing for all of us to keep our eye on the ball, and that is serving the people of the state of Minnesota. And in my case, primarily serving the people of northeastern Minnesota and doing the very best that we can do.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Buck.
Mr. Chairman, we have an opportunity on the range to build a steel mill. $2 billion worth of investment and make steel on the range. Governor's well aware of it. And
We need about an additional $60 million for public infrastructure, gas lines, rail lines, roads, power lines, major state infrastructure for an incredible new industry for Minnesota. The governor's well aware of it. Not one dime, not one red cent in his budget to move forward a major, major industry in the state. $49 million taken out of the 21st Century Minerals Fund to help balance the budget. I can gulp and take that. But now when we have all these major industrial projects on the horizon, isn't it time to put the money back so that DEED, money's administered at DEED, has some tools in the box to negotiate with copper nickel companies and PGM metal companies and value-added steel companies? DEED can't negotiate an economic development package for these major projects without some money, not one dime in the governor's budget to restore the $49 million that he took. We don't have the tools in the box. Now, the person that can advocate for that is the commissioner, and if she's advocating so hard, wouldn't you think we could have picked up a million or two for projects in the neighborhood of a couple billion dollars when we know it is public infrastructure, gas lines, power lines, rail lines? I mean, I think the governor supports the project, but it didn't get into the budget somehow. I mean, it just is a lack of advocacy on the part of the state agency.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question? Comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sitting here and I'm thinking something is just amiss. I really don't understand this. And a couple comments to my dear friend, Senator Bach, about the JobZ program. It's a roaring success out in greater Minnesota. And he did say that there are some areas that it's better. There were years where it was very good. But with all due respect, Senator Bach, prevailing wage did see a decrease in some projects because of what's happened in the last year and a half. But I'm sitting here thinking this is more of a personality conflict, actually. I mean, back in 2003 when we had all the budget cuts and the ethanol payments were taken away, we didn't go after the commissioner of ag. We were terribly upset and we were mad at the governor, but it was his choice. It's what you had to do. I mean, this is truly a black eye to the governor. When you come right down to it, we just want to slap him around a little bit. That's what I'm seeing here. And I can't help also think, because of this personality conflict, is it because, Commissioner, am I right? You are the first female with this board. And so you have the difficulty of working with a agency and working with the governor. That's a totally, I mean, it's a unique situation. So I think she's done a remarkable job. If I heard the figures right, 4,500 new jobs in the last 4 years, I mean, that's pretty impressive. I would like 1% of those jobs down in District 24. And I would love to see the mining industry and everything else take off in northern Minnesota, but not at the expense of this black eye.
Senator Day?
Mr. Chairman.
In response to
yes.
Senator Rosen?
Because to insinuate that this is about a woman is absolutely ridiculous. It's got nothing to do with the gender of the commissioner. It's got everything to do with how she's been running the agency and lack of leadership.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen?
It's very good to hear that. Thank you.
I thought the same thing. Senator Day, did you wish to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen was probably thinking of that because Senator Murphy was talking about the other woman commissioner we have, Molnow, but forget that one. And by the way, I love the 7 minutes, although you didn't have embarrass on there, which I thought we should have had a little thing that said 26 below or something with some snowmobiles riding by it to kind of show the other side that all of my people go up there and have all their fun in the northern part of the state, which we who live in southern Minnesota dearly love. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. But it is interesting. I can remember when I got out of the Navy in the 60s, And I happened to go to college and play basketball in Rochester Junior College, and we played Virginia, and we played Hibbing. And I can remember in the early 60s going up there, and the schools, we used to play in a little gymnasium in Rochester that was like about as big as this, the Armory down there. We got to Virginia and Hibbing. I couldn't believe all the money. I was thinking, whoa, this is like the Taj Mahal of places, because back then things were really good. I mean, things in the mining industry was really hopping, and everybody was making money, and that was wonderful. Then there went through a period of time, you know, then it went the other way. But for anybody to think that for 16 years I've been in the state Senate, for 16 years I've heard this down and out on the Iron Range, and I'm actually getting to the point where, you know what, there's no difference than what we went through in southern Minnesota with corn prices and soybeans and people getting laid off and companies going under and whatever, whatever. And I know when we went through the Northwest, it was like we got to move the air bases up north, and we did all of this. And that's fine, too. I don't even go with that. But since during the Carlson administration, during the Ventura administration, and the Plenty administration, I don't know any commissioner that you guys have had up there that you've ever really liked very well. In fact, I've had long discussions with the other commissioners that have been your commissioners. And the one guy lived in Duluth, my good friend Jim, I think we were driving him a little nervous. But anyway, it seems like the governor has done lots of things for the northern area, and I think he tries to do that. I think the commissioner has done a good job, whether it's the employment, whether it's reducing staff, we've all went through. And as far as somebody saying, well, there's a letter and they're always going to do this, I mean, I doubt if even all of our commissioners that are in the state are afraid to either offer things or not offer them because of the governor. I mean, as you all know, you have conversations with commissioners of different things, and they surely don't take their marching orders all the time from them, and he surely has not involved in all these things that happen within all of these different commissions and boards and all the things that we have going on in the state. I think it's political. I think it's political. And I can't imagine that this is this monstrosity of a problem. You did a good job. I think you got a pretty good chance of probably getting slam dunked and go on to your next, do whatever the next job you're going to do and whatever. But I will compliment you. I think you've done a pretty darn good job, and you followed some pretty tough characters that were up there that tried to do a pretty good job, and they went away knowing that it was pretty well slanted on anything that was to get done, and maybe we're right. Maybe it shouldn't be a government thing. Maybe it shouldn't be connected with us. Maybe the governor should let them do what they want and go that route. So maybe that's something that some of us should offer as a bill instead of kicking around the people up there. Maybe we should move it on out and let somebody else take care of it. But that were my comments, and like I said, for 16 years I've been listening to people tell me two things. When I had a lot of people in southern Minnesota going under, it was always the Iron Range was going under, number one. And number two, it was also always that the person that's managing the RRRB was always doing a bad job and the board didn't like whatever, whatever, whatever. And that's been the 16 years I've been here, and ain't much I'm going to change, but that's my comments, and let's get at it and get on with it.
Mr. Motion, Mr. Chair. Senator Neville.
I apologize that I am not as familiar with the IRRRB maybe as I should be. I haven't served on this committee for a while either, but you're a commissioner. You're appointed by the governor to serve at his pleasure. He could remove you any time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So tell me, what exactly is your duty or your relationship with the board, which is made up of all legislators, I guess? There's three citizens.
Citizen members.
The board, yeah.
So would you care? Set us, you so can explain
have me
that,
answer that, Mr. Chair? Yeah.
Tell in the makeup and the committee.
Sure, the makeup of the board, 13 members on the board, 10 senators. Five senators, five House members, and since 1999, also three citizen members.
So how do they direct your work vis-a-vis the governor directing your work, so, right. Just so I can help understand?
Well, it's an interesting sort of balance. The commissioner is in the executive branch of government, and I'm hired or fired by the governor of the state of Minnesota. And the board approves spending. There's statutory language that gives the board members authority to approve spending. So annually I present a budget before the board. It's approved by the board. And then individual economic development projects have their spending approved by the board and then ultimately the governor. So it's... In a way,
so the governor has to sign off.
It's a little mini legislature up in the Iron Range. Okay.
So the governor or you have to sign off on that budget too?
Yeah, I present the budget, so it's a budget that I approve of, and I'm presenting. It's signed off by the board and then the governor.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yep, it does. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle,
I know we have the Tomasoni motion in front of us. I guess I'd ask colleagues to consider, I think the Senate Business Committee should be coming out with a positive recommendation for this commissioner and the job she has done. And so I'm going to ask colleagues to consider a no vote on the Tomasoni motion in hopes that we'd then be able to bring up a more positive statement on behalf of the commissioner after that. And I'd ask for a roll call vote on the Tomasoni motion.
Okay, there will be a roll call.
Say, Mr. Chair, point of what's the higher motion?
Well, it would be
the motion to confirm or approve would be a higher motion than a motion or which? I don't think
so. No, his motion is before us, and that's a motion to send it to the floor without a recommendation. There are higher motions, but...
That was my question, is if somebody wanted to amend that, what is a
Well, he might do that after his motion is...
We could move to amend it. Wouldn't that be a higher motion?
I think so. Let me just make a small comment. I don't know for what it's worth, but the gentleman from the range probably came into this meeting, I think, with the notion of, quite frankly, cutting off somebody's legs, and if you will, and maybe not confirming. It just seems to me the half-full glass, and I can't speak for you guys, but... is that might be something they're trying to do. Let's wait and see a little bit longer. Maybe something will work out. And I can't talk for you guys, but maybe you want to affirm what I'm just saying. But it could be the fact that they're trying to help. And it doesn't sound like it earlier, I understand. But the life blood, the stream is still there. There she's still, more than on life support, let's put it that way. And I maybe they're trying to half full. I don't know. Just my reaction. But anyway, the secretary,
Mr. Chair,
will take the role on the Tomasoni motion to send to the Senate floor without a recommendation of the confirmation of Commissioner Lehman. Clerk will take the role.
Senator Metzen?
Aye.
Senator Bach?
Yes.
Senator Bonoff?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Day?
No.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Gimsey?
No.
Not real good, but I think.
Senator Koch?
No.
Very good.
Senator Latz?
Yes.
Senator Michelle?
No.
Senator Murphy?
Yes.
Senator Neville? Do you want to say in the microphone?
No.
Nope. Thank you. Senator Rosen?
No.
Senator Saltzman?
Aye.
Senator Scheid?
Yes.
Senator Skoy?
Yes.
Senator Sparks?
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni?
Yes.
Murphy votes aye.
Thank you, Senator Murphy.
Stay back.
There being 11 ayes and 7 noes, the motion does prevail. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the agenda is a presentation of the biopharmaceutical industry. We have a...
I noted that.
I've heard it's a very presentation and one that we should listen to. And first up will be Ray Frost, the Director of Government Affairs from MGI. Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed as you'd like. And I've been informed, members, that on Friday morning, 9:30 a.m., Senator or Representative Mahoney's committee is going to meet at the St. Jude Medical Building in Minnetonka, and they manufacture medical devices, technology for cardiac, neurological, and chronic pain patients worldwide. And the bus is leaving from 8:45 in front of the state office building. And so if you'd have any interest in this at all, let Representative Mahoney's office know. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is, for the record, Ray Frost, Director of Government Affairs for MGI Pharma. We are here before you today to talk about the biopharmaceutical industry in Minnesota and really highlight MGI Pharma. I appreciate the opportunity to present in front of the committee, and I think this is going to be a very different story than what people hear when they typically think of pharmaceutical industry. They think of the large boys. They think of Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Pfizer. I think the story we're about to tell you today is a little bit different, and we appreciate, again, your time. Next to me is Dave Moline, Senior Director of Corporate and Government Affairs, and he's going to walk through the presentation for you.
Yeah, welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Dave Moline. As Ray had said, I'm Senior Director of Corporate and Government Affairs at MGI Pharma. And just want to take a few minutes just to kind of walk you through MGI Pharma. For some of you, it may be a new company. For some of you, may be aware of the fact that it's actually been in business for 27 years. Actually, MGI Pharma is a particular success in terms of a spin-out in this particular industry. It was spun out of the University of Minnesota back 27 years ago. As Ray had alluded to, really our focus is in the biopharmaceutical industry. It's probably a new term for some. Pharmaceutical, I think, is probably pretty well known. If you think of pharma or pharmaceutical, you're really thinking about synthesizing drugs or making drugs with traditional chemical approaches, chemistry. Biotechnology, however, is really trying to use biological processes to make drugs. And where pharma or pharmaceuticals is really the past and kind of older technology in some ways, really the bio area, that's the future. So we're rooted in the past, focused on the future, and really at this point kind of becoming a new organization focused in the biopharmaceuticals. Our business model is to acquire, to develop, and to commercialize proprietary products, and really focused in oncology. That's really where our roots have been as we've grown as an organization the last 6 years, and also in acute care, so really cancer patients and patients that are hospitalized. So just to touch briefly on the history of the company, back in 1979, this was a successful spin-out out of the University of Minnesota. At that time, it was focused in bioagriculture. At that time, it was felt that that was really the fastest path to becoming a profitable company, which, as any publicly traded company who has shareholders, that is one of the goals. Well, that's been a 27-year journey. We've had 27 years of no profit. This year, in 2007, we are on the cusp of being a profitable organization. Albeit modest profit, but clearly a milestone in this journey we've taken. So just, back when we used to sell in late 70s, farmers were our customers. We had herbicide-resistant corn seed. We had a canine Lyme's disease vaccine. These were the products that we had. As we grew forward, though, we clearly realized after about 15 years we needed to move into human health. And we had a capable R&D organization that was able to develop a product called Salagen. Salagen is a product that's used for patients that have head and neck cancer and suffer from dry mouth. It's a very, very debilitating side effect. That was discovered here in Minnesota. It was developed and taken through the regulatory process with FDA in two different indications and successfully launched on the market. For about 10 years, that was really the fuel for growth for MGI Pharma until about 2000. Really a shift in focus. Some new management came in, and we said we need to move out of kind of a specialty pharma model and really look towards the future. As you all know, who probably have friends, loved ones who've experienced and dealt with cancer, there's huge unmet patient need here. And that's really what drives all of our associates every day. So focusing on that, and at that time in about 2000, in their Bloomington offices, which is a corporate headquarters, we had about 25 or 30 people, 30 associates. We embarked on a pretty robust mission to acquire products. And when I say acquire products, we're talking about bringing cancer products, acquiring companies that are, in most cases, outside Minnesota, and bringing them to Minnesota. Many times bringing their associates to Minnesota, the Blooming facility, many times hiring people out of the University of Minnesota, and sometimes hiring people out of the other medtech, medical device, and pharma companies here in the state. So we acquired several products. 2001, we acquired Aloxi Injection, and I'll touch in more detail on this particular product. That has been the driver for our growth in the past 4 or 5 years. We acquired that product from a Swiss-based clinical development organization. So bring a product to Minnesota from Switzerland. In 2004, on September 1st, we acquired really three companies on the same day, September 1st. It was a busy day for us. We acquired a product called Dacogen for a type of leukemia from a California-based company, brought it to Minnesota. We acquired a biotechnology company, which is now MGI Pharma Biologics in Boston, a hotbed for biotechnology, brought the asset to Minnesota. And we also acquired a particular product called Sephoris from a company in New Jersey, which is, again, kind of a hotbed for biopharmaceutical companies. Brought those assets to Minnesota in 2004. Between 2004 and 2006, it was quite a ramp up in terms of number of associates. As I said, in 2000, we had about 25 associates in our Bloomington office. Now we have between 225 people and moving towards 250. And most recently, we acquired Guilford, which is a Baltimore-based facility. They had manufacturing capabilities and also some very important assets for acute care patients, which I'll touch on as well. And most recently, we've had Dacogen approved by the FDA for a type of leukemia. So as I said, our focus is in the biopharmaceutical industry. Most of our success has been in the oncology area. We have three current facilities, our corporate office in Bloomington, about 225 associates strong now, our Baltimore facility, approximately 150 associates, and our Lexington or Boston facility, about 25. And we have about 200 field-based people as well, kind of in the sales and marketing organization. So about 600 associates total. I'm going to touch on three products that we have commercially available that we sell in the U.S. Our business focus at this point is really in North America. We own worldwide rights to all of our assets except for Aloxi. We have commercial focus in the U.S., and we really have partnerships in the rest of the world. But our aspiration is to grow into those areas as well. We have a very deep and maturing pipeline, which I think you'll find somewhat interesting because, again, there's a story for each and every one of these cancer products and acute care products about being developed in another part of the country and another part of the world, but consistently we're trying to bring these assets and bring these products and oftentimes bring these jobs to Minnesota.
It's a different slide, but yeah, that's interesting.
Yes. I guess the thing I'd like to focus here on is the fact that our big focus on bringing unmet products to patients that have real needs in the cancer area. But we all need to focus on growing sales and growing earnings. We've been unprofitable for 27 years. To put this into context for you, there's 1,500 biopharmaceutical companies in the U.S. About 300 are publicly traded, most of the NASDAQ exchange. There's about two or three dozen that are profitable. So it's a high, high hurdle rate to success in this particular industry. MGI Pharma is a Minnesota-based company, is on the cusp of being one of these two to three dozen companies here in 2007. Go ahead. So our lead product is called Aloxi. If you've had patients that have undergone chemotherapy, you probably know very well that nausea and vomiting is a very, very debilitating side effect. Aloxi is a fourth entrant to a market. It's a product that we acquired from a Swiss-based company, and it's very, very different from the other products that are on the market. And I should note that we compete against Big Pharma. We compete against Sanofi Aventis, GlaxoSmithKline, and Roche. We're fourth entrant to the market. But this product was different. When patients undergo chemotherapy, they get an injection of what's called a 5-HT3 antagonist to prevent this chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting about 30 minutes prior to chemotherapy. The first-generation agents work for about 16 to 18 hours. Chemotherapy tends to work for several days. So with these first-generation agents, patients will take oral follow-up therapy. I don't know if you've ever been nauseous and tried to eat or take pills, but it doesn't work very well. So the fact that Aloxi worked as a single injection and worked for 5 days with no oral follow-up therapy really was an unmet need for patients. And as we introduced this product in September of 2003, in about 12 months, we went from fourth to first in the market as a small company competing against Big Pharma. And this has really been the fuel that has driven our company and really has been a tremendous, tremendous benefit to patients that that I know I have the pleasure to interact with every day.
Who's chair? Oh, Madam Chair. Could I ask a question at this point?
Please, Senator Messon.
This might be a good place for me to I'm going to branch out a little bit, but using this Aloxi drug perhaps as an example, can you help? I mean, we hear a lot about the outrageous profits that drug companies make, and then the counter to that is, well, they have to put all this money into research and development, and you just said that only a couple dozen of these pharmaceuticals make a profit out of 1,500. Could you give us an idea just for this one drug? I mean, you've got a patent on it, I assume. It took you a period of time to develop it, which used up a portion of the patent time. How much do you sell that for? How much more time do you have the proprietary right to use that? Could you give us an idea how a product like Aloxi actually comes to market and how it's profitable for your company?
Absolutely, if I may.
Jolene.
Aloxi has a very interesting history, actually. It's been around since the 1960s. Its generic name is called Palonosetron. It was discovered by a company called Syntex Pharmaceuticals back in the 60s, which is obviously California-based company, which was acquired by Roche Pharmaceuticals back in the 80s. Roche had no interest in oncology at that time, although interestingly enough, they do now. So that product sat on their shelves through the 80s and into the 90s. A Swiss-based company called Helsin Pharmaceuticals, they acquired the product. They were a clinical development organization, and they did the necessary clinical test in humans to bring it forward to a phase 3 program, which is the largest program, the most, expense-intensive program in clinical development. We were aware of this product based upon some prior interactions with other companies, and we essentially went and found it, worked with our Swiss partners to bring it to the market. So it's been around a long time. It had a lot of competition. And just typically, you know, you can look at Tufts University will cite the statistics for drug development. On average, it takes roughly 8 to 10 years to bring a product from discovery through the regulatory process if you're successful. On average, usually 2 in about 100 products will make it to market. And on average, the cost of going from discovery through clinical testing phase 1, 2, and 3 is in the neighborhood of $800 to $900 million today. So well, that the in a, go ahead.
You said that Aloxi actually had been around then. So is there no proprietary protection for that anymore?
Do you just know
how to make it more efficiently, or what?
Yeah, very good question. In terms of the proprietary protection, it has patent life to 2015. Now I'm not an IP attorney, so
Okay.
Just for any of you that are attorneys out there, there are different ways to patent products in the pharmaceutical industry. Some are manufacturing patents. Some are process patents, as you can imagine. Some are for method of use for the particular type of treatment, et cetera. But we do have some patent protection in this particular case.
And how long is patent protection?
2015.
I mean, how much have you used already? Isn't it like 16 or 18 years?
Yeah, it's 17 years.
17?
Yep,
okay, so you've used up two, and you're going to be making a good profit now. You're number one, you said. So for the next, till 2015.
Well, understand that.
You used half of it up, I guess. You got eight more years to go.
Right, right. Okay. And the unique thing about the biopharmaceutical industry as a manufacturing industry is most of the expenses that we have are recognized in arrears. And as I said, can you cite Tufts University, but it's $800 to $900 million. Well, some certainly drugs are more, some are certainly less.
Okay, one last question. Sure. And I think some others have questions. But, again, I don't expect you to release proprietary information, but this is a number one product. It sounds like it's a pretty good one, that lots of people are going to want it. You're going to try to get on formularies from different company, health insurance company. How do you answer people who say your drug costs too much?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, one thing I want to clear up for folks, though, is while, as David said, we are number one in the clinic oncologist market, we have the number one market share. Aloxi, which is public information, did about $250 million in revenue last year. So when I said to you in the very beginning of the testimony that this is a different story than what folks typically hear about the pharmaceutical industry, Aloxi and all of our projections will never be a billion-dollar drug. Many people here have always the billion-dollar. Aloxi will never become close to $1 billion. We will close up this year. We haven't reported earnings yet, but probably somewhere in that neighborhood that we did last year as well. So, yes, it's the number one drug in the clinic market, but that number one doesn't get us to that $1 billion, what a lot of people think. The projections with different indications for Aloxi, which are going through the FDA approval process right now, indication for postoperative nausea and vomiting, an oral capsule, we may at some point do maybe $500 million worth of revenue for Aloxi. That's at its peak sales, at its peak. So, again, that differentiated story. If there's one thing I can leave you with about MGI Pharma today, if you remember nothing from this presentation, I hope you remember one thing. We're committed to bringing products that are meeting, differentiated products that are meeting unmet patient needs. We are not a company that is bringing Me Too products, which you've very heard. The Me Too products, you know, the Cialis, Levitra, that type of stuff. The products we are bringing to market are for smaller niche patients, which automatically mean less revenues, less patients can use them. We'll talk about Dacogen next. The patient population for that drug, total patient population, is about 20 to 30,000 patients.
Thank you, Mr. Frost. And Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, you're talking about this proprietariness of your drug, but you named the generic. Is the generic not licensed for this, or what's the status of the generic that you named?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that's just a generic name for it. Aloxi's the brand name. Palinositron's just a generic name. Sorry about for that confusion.
Okay, other questions?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Sorry, we won't remember your name either.
Scheid here.
What was your name?
I just wanted to say that I've had Aloxi 16 times in 13 months, and I haven't thrown up once. So, if that's, you know, I tell you.
And
that's a pretty stiff chemo.
And we did not know that.
So, I don't know. I can't tell because, you know, each chemo is about, they charge close to $10,000 for it, but they don't get reimbursed that much. They don't differentiate how much, but I've been getting some real serious chemo, and it's an amazing thing. I always say, what's that little bag? Oh, that's your Aloxi. So,
Madam Chair,
good stuff.
That's an outstanding testimony. I am curious, so how much does it cost for a treatment? Does that vary depending on who's paying for it, too?
Madam Chair, if I may. On average, the cost of Aloxi is about $325 per vial. To put that into context, I was talking about the first-generation products, Zofran, Ansma, and Kytrol in this particular case. Their treatment is for the first day of chemotherapy and then oral follow-up. we tried to price Aloxi based on about 2 or 2.5 days of therapy versus really 5 with the other agents. So if you look at the first day of therapy, it's somewhat of a premium price. If you look at the 5 days of therapy, it's actually about half.
Right.
Thank you. Other questions? Sure. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Millian, I don't want to delay your wonderful presentation here with technical questions, but being a businessman, I have to ask, how can you remain unprofitable for 27 years and be here today?
And Mr. Moline or Mr. Frost, would you like to answer that?
Madam Chair, we were prepared for that question. We got in the House, too, so.
Mr. Frost, yes.
Madam Chair, if I may, very good question. If you recall the statistics that I talked about, 1,500 biopharmaceutical companies, 300 publicly traded, 2 or 3 dozen really successful, most companies don't make it. The reason why is there's tremendous infrastructure, not always in people, but in terms of collaborations where you work with universities, you work with other companies to acquire assets, to do different stages of clinical research. It just flat out costs a lot of money. You know, to give you an example, as a drug, if it does make it through to phase 3 development, the cost per patient to do a regulatory trial is $25,000. So if you're studying 1,000 or 2,000 patients, those dollars add up pretty quick. Now, depending upon the stage your company may be at, if you're a privately funded company through private equity, venture capital, angel funding, et cetera, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000, it was much easier to get that type of money. Talk to guys that run those type of companies now, and it's downright challenging. They want drugs that have been through phase 2. They've shown proof of principle. They work. They're effective. Side effects are all in check. As a publicly traded company, you get money based on growing revenue through the products that we sell, investing back in research. And in fact, last year we invested $100 million back into research. It was over a third of our revenues. On average, in the big pharma world, they invest roughly 11 to 15% back into R&D. So it's a very, very expense and capital-intensive business model.
Other questions? Okay, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to continue, Dacogen is a product for a type of leukemia called myelodysplastic syndrome. This is an orphan drug. Orphan drug means it's a very small patient population, high unmet need. Dacogen was approved by the FDA and treats this particular type of leukemia, as I said. Very successful. 3 years ago, there were really no therapies for this type of cancer. Now there are 3 that are available, our company and 2 others, so tremendous benefits from this particular product. Go ahead and move forward. Another product that we have in the market is called Gliadel. Gliadel is for a very rare form of brain cancer. This is a product that's been on the market for 10 years. Last year, we treated 2,100 patients, 2,000 patients. The great thing about this product is there's nothing else that exists after a surgeon excises a tumor from the brain. This particular product, it's a wafer impregnated with chemotherapy that's placed in the cavity. It basically slow releases chemotherapy until the patient can get on systemic chemotherapy and radiation. If it were not for companies like MGI Pharma, small biopharmaceutical companies, having worked in a big pharma company before and having brought products forward to new product committees, to the management committee, unless the product could sell at least $500 million, that was a hurdle rate. They really didn't want to hear anything about that. The challenging thing in cancer treatment is products aren't that big. But clearly, the importance of companies like MGI Pharma is that they can basically make ends meet with smaller products and bring valuable products to cancer patients.
And Madam Chair, if I might, Senator Neville, to your point before, peak sales of this product, we estimate about $35 million. Yes, I said that right, $35 million. Last year, we did about $28 million.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville.
When I heard your explanation on the need for venture capital just to be able to operate unprofitably for a number of years. To what extent, you know, there are all these groups out there, the Relays for Life that raise money, the National Cancer Society. Do they help fund companies like you? Or who do they give their money to for research in the cancer area?
Madam Chair, if I may, many of the patient advocacy groups, you know, Susan G. Coleman, National Coalition of Breast Cancer, there's many organizations that do tremendous work, tremendous fundraising for cancer patients and cancer patient causes. I can tell you that that the funding that they raise does not go to public or private companies like ours. In many cases, they're to patient initiatives, to some clinical research, but most of that will be maybe channeled through the National Cancer Institute or NIH.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Please continue.
If I may continue, in terms of to the senator's question about the expense, at one point in time, MGI was a one product on the market, one product in development company. With any company, you need to diversify your risk. As products move through the clinical development pipeline, some of the risk is taken out. But along the way, there's products that just flat out don't work. So you need to diversify your risk. We've done that with the products you see here, and I'll touch on them in more detail. But I guess the thing I'd like to point out that Aquavan on the top, that's a product we brought to Minnesota from Baltimore. Aloxia, of course, from Switzerland. Sephoris is from New Jersey. Dacogen from California, Amlimogene from Boston, Irofulven from a collaboration with the University of California, San Diego, Zyke 300 from a Boston facility, and the last two products from a collaboration that we have with Johns Hopkins. So as we bring in these assets to MGI Pharma and bring much of the work to Bloomington, it does also create jobs as well. In terms of growing our company, sustaining profitability, you need to move products along in clinical development. As you can see, we have a pretty robust late-stage pipeline, and what's listed here are the potential peak sales. And when I say peak sales, they're typically 4 or 5 years out on the market.
So you can see, Madam Chair and Senator Neville and members, that there's nothing on that that is the typical story, as I've talked about before, which you see is the billion-dollar hurdle for a lot of folks. And, you know, many of ours, if you add them all up, just about come to $1 billion at peak sales.
We talked about acute care products or hospital-based products. Aquavan is a unique product for sedation. So if you or anyone you know has ever gone colonoscopies, bronchoscopies, minor surgeries, this is a product that can sedate patients but do it in a fashion where they can quickly be sedated, quickly wake up from their surgery, and hopefully drive home. That's the concept here. So better patient care, more efficiency for the healthcare system. Amlimogene, if you've been following the late press recently, there's been a lot in the press regarding HPV vaccines or human papillomavirus vaccines. Tremendous breakthrough that has been made where young 9 to 13-year-old boys and girls can be vaccinated against this terrible virus, which leads to cervical cancer. Well, these vaccines, we hope in time, will be effective, although it will likely take a generation to vaccinate all of these young ones. Our approach here with amlimogene, it's a therapeutic. So as women are diagnosed with high-grade cervical dysplasia today, which leads to cervical cancer, typically, to cure this, they undergo a very invasive surgery called the LEAP procedure. The problem with this particular procedure is, one, it's very invasive, and two, it can often lead to non-fertility, trouble for women carrying pregnancies to term, et cetera. The alternative that we're trying to offer here is an injection in the thigh with the same resolution rate as the surgery. It's very exciting. It's very high-tech. This was actually a technology that came out of Harvard University and really was used to start the company that's now Boston-based.
So are these trials, are they taking place here in Minnesota? Are you coordinating them out of the state? Because when you talk about bringing products in, then once they're here, do you do all of this other research here in Minnesota?
Yeah, Madam Chair, very, very good question. Depending on the phase of development, and for example, with amlimogene, it's in phase 3 development, which means that you try to replicate prior clinical results in large randomized trials. So you have several sites, both in the U.S., often in Europe, sometimes in South America, et cetera. Actually, Levi Downs, Dr. Downs at the University of Minnesota, is one of the principal investigators on this pivotal trial. So there is clinical work going on here in Minnesota. There's several other centers around the country and in Europe at this point.
Thank you.
If I may continue, I guess just the point I'd like to touch on here, in terms of recruiting, you know, as I said, I came to MGI in 2000. At that point, we had about 25 or 30 people in our Bloomington facility. One of our biggest challenges, and really from an economic development standpoint, is hiring skilled people. People that have the industry experience, that have the academic experience. And right now, what we need more MGI pharmas, very frankly. Many times we have to relocate people to Minnesota, and it's darn hard to relocate people on days like this.
Yes.
And you may laugh, but it is. It's true. People will say that all the time. So I say it's someone in jest, and I'm a Minnesota boy. I grew up in Buffalo, just west of here. I moved here from Southern California. My wife, who's from Southern California, asks us why on days like this. But the point here with recruiting, we have to have the academic infrastructure. We have to be able to spin off and build other companies, biopharmaceutical companies like MGI Pharma. There has to be similar talent. There has to be an environment where other companies like MGI can grow up and develop. And I know you heard from Dale Wallstrom and Don Gerhardt previously about the importance of this and about really the vision for 2025. And these things are critically, critically important. And we recognize that as a company at MGI as well. Just go. So just to kind of recap, I guess the story of MGI Pharma, it's a 27-year journey, 27 years of unprofitability on the cusp of really being successful. And as I said, although MGI will continue to bring products that meet the needs for cancer patients, acute care patients, it's got to be a broader effort. We need to have partners here in the state. We need to bring other companies to the state that particularly will focus on cancer. There's tremendous work going on at the University of Minnesota. There's tremendous work going on at the Mayo. You know, the Mayo University Genomics Partnership is a tremendous step forward, but there's a long time from that discovery, getting products to market. And unless you can bring those products forward to market where they're actually affecting the lives of patients, you know, we need to think about where we're investing our money. So there's a gap right now between the research and commercialization, and I guess that's a challenge for all of us to really try to work on that gap and narrow that gap. So thank you.
So on your legislative issues, you'll be covering that, Mr. Frost?
Yeah, just very quickly, Madam Chair, we put this slide in because when we've done a little outreach to the state legislators in Minnesota, and they've asked us, well, this is a great story. It's a very compelling story. We're proud to have you here in Minnesota. What are some of the things we can do either to help you or not harm you? And these are just a few examples of some very big issues that come up from time to time. And in my years here as a staffer and lobbyist and other capacities, a lot of folks tend to want to paint a broad brush of the pharmaceutical industry. And that broad brush, unfortunately, really adversely impacts us. You may be trying to poke the sleeping bear, and by sleeping bear I mean large pharma. And for the most part, you might give them a little black eye. But some of the policies you discuss here, while giving a black eye to large pharma, really have an adverse impact against us. And so these are just some of the issues, the sales and marketing legislation. And why I mention that is a lot of states, and I've listed them here, Minnesota actually was the first state to do it, but back in 1994. But other states have gone much further now, and they're requiring every interaction you have with doctors and others. And to some extent, I wouldn't debate the philosophy of that issue because I understand why people might be wanting to do it. But the fact of the matter is when all of these initial states are adding all of this, if you will, compliance onto pharmaceutical companies, it's a little easier. I don't know how easy. I don't work for them. It's a little easier for a Pfizer or a Merck or other people to potentially add an FTE to fill out all these reports. When we're only a 600-person company that's not yet been profitable, we have drag-out meetings about adding FTEs when we go through a round of our budgets. And when I have to look, and Dave has to look,
the CEO and the board in the eye and say, we need to add an FTE. And the reason we need to add an FTE is because of all these requirements that we have to fulfill by law. And by the way, that FTE will absolutely, no offense to that person who gets the job, but absolutely offer no value. No value to the company. All they will do is fill out paperwork. That's all they will do. They won't help the pipeline. They won't help sales. They won't help patients. All they do, that has a really adverse impact against us. Further regulations of clinical trials, you, Madam Chair, you had mentioned that. What I mean by this is when you're bringing drugs that aren't erectile dysfunction drugs to market, when you're bringing drugs that affect a patient population like the Gliadel wafer of 2,500 patients or 20,000 to 30,000 like Dacogen, it's hard to find patients to register in clinical trials. So if you make it harder for companies like us to find those patients, it makes it that much harder for us to get the drug to market and potentially increases our costs going through that process.
Is that something that the state has control over, or are those federal issues?
Madam Chair, excellent question. For the most part, up until recently, the federal government has most control over that. But recently, there has been some states who have wanted to create state boards of clinical trials where there's information and to replace the IRB process. Also have a website where people can look on about all the clinical trials and mandate more information. So there's potential right now. Other states are talking about this. There's potential that there would be 40, 50, 25, however many you want. We already got to deal with the federal government. There's potential that each state will have its own process to register clinical trials, keep the data up on a website. Again, that would add a lot of work to us. Maybe some value in there, but I think, as we all tend to do, overreact sometimes. We might be swinging the pendulum a little bit too far, unfortunately.
So, Mr. Frost, at this point, we do not have anything, and just wanted to check.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you do not have anything right now, but you actually are close because there was a bill that was introduced last year by former Senator Hottinger, and a bill was introduced this year to further regulate clinical trials, specifically in Minnesota, to have a database, and that's something we would have some significant concerns. And then you've all heard about this a lot, but DTC legislation, DTC, direct-to-consumer advertising. Now, again, I would not want to debate the philosophy of some of the ads we've all seen on TV. We have some concerns, and maybe rightfully so. But, again, not to overreact to it, hopefully. I think there are some DTC ads that really do a real strong value for patients. And as Dave said, we compete with Aloxi against Big Pharma. And Big Pharma, specifically one company, GlaxoSmithKline, was our biggest competitor in the 5-HT3 market with a drug called Zofran. Now, GlaxoSmithKline has various therapeutic areas, so they have a sales force of about 9,000, 10,000 people around the country. But that's for different areas, not just oncology. We have a sales force, as Dave said, of about 150. So we have this drug. We have to compete with a very large company, a very successful large company. How do we do that? Well, one of the ways we as a company decided to do that was we embarked on a DTC campaign because we wanted to go directly to the consumer. The campaign was not on television, but the campaign was in women's health magazines because Aloxi, while indicated for chemotherapy-induced nausea vomiting, is really a wonder drug for breast cancer patients. So we went into Oprah magazine, Good Housekeeping, Red Book, Reader's Digest, all the women's health type magazines that end up in an oncologist's office. And actually, this is the ad. Now, you have it in front of you. I think when we all think of DTC ads, we all have a vision in our head of the ones we may not like. But I think this one gives you a very different sense. And actually, this woman, members, is not an actress. She's a cancer patient, two-time survivor. She had breast cancer brain cancer and ovarian cancer, if I'm correct. But again, when you try to take a tool away from us to compete in what is a very hard market to hopefully become profitable and continue to do what we have been doing, this has been a very useful tool for us. When we go out and see patients, they may not know of MGI Pharma because we're so small, but when we say Aloxi, they'll go, oh, yeah, I remember your ad. And, yeah, I want to go to the doctor and I want to ask them for that drug specifically because – as Senator Neville said before, there absolutely are formulary issues. Aloxi competes in what is for the 5-HT3 market, as Dave said before, and our largest competitor, GSK, their drug just went generic. So private pay, Blue Cross Blue Shields will try to push a cheaper alternative for folks, even though this is absolutely a better drug. And it's not a better drug because I'm telling you, it's a better drug because the FDA tells you. We have head-to-head trials with it, all that information. So again, just when you have your debates up here, know that There are large pharma companies that have a place in the market. There are also small pharma companies that have a place in the market. And don't paint us all with that same brush. So with that, I'll let you.
Right. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you to what you are providing for patients everywhere. You know, Senator Scheid has talked about her lack of nausea, and we are so grateful for her health. And I have a close friend right now who's going through chemo and has not been nauseous and has talked about that. And I'm sure we all have family members and friends that we know. So I think we do need to do whatever we can to support the smaller drug companies. And I'll look into that legislation you mentioned.
Thank you.
Senator Scheid.
And I didn't want to trivialize the fact that I haven't been sick, because it's so important, because it helps people keep going with their chemotherapy.
Right.
It's because there are people that have, over the years, have been sick, so sick they couldn't get the next chemo treatment. So it's really not just a very nice, you know, side effect or effect. I guess they're all side effects that it, you know, diminishes, or in my case, it totally eliminates nausea. I just want to know what, when it says preclinical, I need some of this GCP2 inhibitor. That's the chemo-induced neuropathy, which I have. That's going to be something that's probably even less number of people, because probably more people get nauseated from chemo than get neuropathy. I don't know, but anyway, I just want you to know I have that and I need some.
See what you can do for her.
Madam Chair, if I may address Senator's question. Chemotherapy-induced neuropathies, it's basically tingling in your fingers, you know, flat-out numbness in your feet. My mother-in-law is going through ovarian cancer treatment. She has the same thing. She has days where she just can't get up and walk. There are no approved drugs on the market for this debilitating disease. And actually, Senator, there are more and more of the new regimens that cause peripheral neuropathy. They're very effective in terms of knocking out the cancer,
right,
but they're very debilitating from a standpoint of the hands and the feet.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, Senator Koch.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for the presentation. It was excellent. I just am wondering the stock symbol. You didn't mention that.
Madam Chair and members, we are a publicly traded company. The stock symbol is MOGN, for your information.
Thank you.
And if I could, I know you're pressed for time, but if I could just say this one last thing. We didn't have time today because of the your previous conversation. But I have to Senator Scheid's point, I have a patient video that's about 6 minutes, and when I come around to talking to some of you, hopefully I can share it with you, because it talks about her. It doesn't promote MGI at all. It talks about her getting diagnosed with cancer, going through a first round of chemotherapy, and getting so sick that she had to be hospitalized for 5 days. And when her son came and picked her up, and she says in the video, she said to her son, "This is it. I'm done." And her son said, "What do you mean you're done?" And she said, "Either the treatment's killing me or the cancer's killing me, and I'd rather the cancer kill me because I ain't doing this." And actually, she's from Minnesota, and she was being treated at the University of Minnesota. And her nurse called her and said, "I heard you had a really tough time." And she said, "Yeah, it was real bad." And she said, "Well, there's another drug out there called Aloxi. You might want to try it." And she had a fight because it wasn't on formulary at the place she was going. But she's got it. She eventually got it after a lot of fighting. She never got sick again. She always said, "I never felt good, but I never threw up. I was allowed to live my life," and now she's in remission. So it's a wonderful patient story to kind of highlight what you just talked about.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing all of this information, making us more aware of what's happening in Minnesota in this important industry. And please keep all of us apprised of new developments and how we can help you, because this committee truly is interested in you know, promoting these kind of areas in our economy and ways that we can be more helpful to you in the future.
Good job away.
Well, thank you.
Meeting adjourned.